Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black hole, black hole. You are.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kathy Bostrom for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. It's time we took hippie women seriously. Long before girl bosses and trad wives, these countercultural women embodied female power. Let's give them their due. Something strange keeps happening to me on tour for my new book, The Acid Queen, a biography of Rosemary Leary, the brilliant, fearless woman who helped shape the psychedelic revolution from behind the scenes, only to be erased from its history. In my travels across the country, there's almost always a woman of a certain age in the audience who listens more intently than the rest. Sometimes she wears her history, a pattern maxi skirt, oversized dangling earrings, rows of crystal necklaces, knuckles covered in rings, but other times she looks no different than the librarians of my youth, prim and neat, an open cardigan over a pastel Lands' End button-down. Invariably, she approaches. She never takes up too much of my time, but she just has to tell me something. "Thank you," she says. "Thank you for telling Rosemary's story. I've come to learn more about this graciousness." What she's really saying is, "Thank you for taking me seriously." Because the reality is that few do. This woman is a member of an underappreciated and understudied group in American history, hippie women, hedonists and bell-bottoms, victims of the sexual politics of their era, which were at once too free and too constrictive. Of course, there are exceptions, Stevie Nicks, Janis Joplin, Michelle Phillips, and Grace Slick, most notably. But by and large, the hundreds of thousands of women who identified as hippies during the height of the counterculture movement in the late 1960s have been rejected as historical footnotes by academia and the wider culture. Still, hippie women continue to shape the culture, from the ubiquitousness of astrology, the focus on organic whole foods, the home birth movement, vaccine skepticism, and other alternative medicine practices, to the growing interest in polyamory and communal living. Yet, if you search the academic record, you will find a short list of texts devoted to this group. I encountered this gap firsthand while researching The Acid Queen. Rosemary Woodruff Leary's brief but impactful marriage to Timothy Leary, the high priest of LSD and consciousness expansion, made her a hippie household name. She was the Acid Queen, or the High Priestess, the living embodiment of the major tenets of the hippie movement. She lived on a commune where free love and communal child rearing were de rigueur. She hung with the Beatles, Alan Watts, and Allen Ginsberg. Gloria Steinem sneered at her. The Black Panthers gave her asylum after she busted her husband out of prison. The Weather Underground conspired with her on a jailbreak. She was a Zelig, a hippie woman who lived a truly cinematic life. Yet no one remembers her. There are reasons for that absence. She lived a good bulk of her life underground, dodging the law and her ex-husband. But I also think that the culture didn't want to remember her, just as it didn't want to remember her cohort. Rosemary was a searcher and a seeker of meaning and peak experiences. She immersed herself in the tarot, astrology, and I Ching, tools of divination. She dropped a mind-blowing amount of LSD on a regular basis and pulled indiscreetly from Taoism and Hinduism. She was convinced that she was among the awakened ones, cocooned together with her fellow seekers in a bubble of specialness, a kind of spiritual narcissism that we see on TikTok and Instagram today. Rosemary was divorced twice before meeting Leary, before the age of 25, astoundingly brave and progressive for a woman of that era. Yet she also fell into a toxic gender dynamic with Leary, contorting herself to be the feminine ideal, the perfect yin to her husband's uber-masculine yang. She took his crap, cooked his dinner, and raised his children the best she could. She went to jail for him and lived on the run, dedicating herself, even after they separated, to preserving his legacy, in the process erasing herself from posterity. But she also found great power and satisfaction in her wifely role. This is partially why it's so hard to study hippie women. They are a challenging combination of progressive and regressive. Despite all the talk of revolution and consciousness raising, strict gender hierarchies remained. The limited scholarship that exists on hippie women often emphasizes this kind of exploitation, how they were saddled with the domestic work and the child rearing, just as their mothers had been. Terrible things happened to women in the counterculture, much of it never reported. I spoke to several children of hippies who were reported being sexually assaulted. Some took LSD as young as 9. There were stories of teenage women who arrived with San Francisco's Haight Street-inspired dreams of free love and communal living and ended up leaving town 6 months later, dead-eyed and broke, with a baby on the way and no one to support it. These, too, are the stories we never hear. All of this makes for a complicated character study. Rosemary, in particular, made lots of mistakes. Embarrassing ones, insensitive ones, appropriating from cultures with impunity, decisions that would get her canceled today. She did things I would never do and things I'll never understand, 3 generations removed. But dismissing hippie women outright because of this inherent inconsistency means losing crucial lessons about survival, about alternative ways of living, about questioning systems of power. While researching Rosemary and her friends and lovers, I encountered so many stories of resilience. Women living underground and on the run for years, successfully raising 4 children, a young mother with an infant abandoned by her husband in the Canadian wilderness in the height of winter, and managing to survive by gathering enough plants and nutrients from roots and roughage. Women who tended fires and raised chickens, who delivered babies without being trained as midwives, homesteaders who held communities together through sheer force of will, psychedelic guides who soothed and calmed people cracked by bad trips. Erica Dyke, a historian who studies health and social justice, has noticed the gap since she began studying psychedelic history in 2001. In 2024, she edited Women and Psychedelics, a collection of essays published by the website Chakruna, which spotlights unseen and unsung women in psychedelic history. With a little creativity and generosity of inquiry, we can reclaim these women as renegades. There is a lot of wisdom to be recovered from that past, she said. Dyke notes that perspective is particularly relevant to the emerging psychedelic sciences as they continue to enter the mainstream. While men have been boosters for the broad acceptance of psychedelics, women have historically been more willing to think about the harm they may cause. Listening to women, Deke explains, may actually allow us to think about psychedelics in a more sustained way. There are lessons to be learned even from the messiest of people. And these complicated hippie women, who are neither trad wife enough nor girl boss enough, to use today's prevailing dichotomous polls, have hard-earned wisdom to share, and I believe more accurately represent the confusing and contradictory reality of womanhood today. I take them seriously, as I hope you will. They were there. They remember. And it is long past time we listen. That's It's Time We Took Hippie Women Seriously by Susanna Cahalan. Up next, why your hair is thinning and what you can do about it. Before you panic, read this, by Grace Gold and Sabrina Talbert. As women, the relationship we have with our hair can be very personal. It can be a form of identity and pride, whether you're rocking thick waves or pin-straight bangs. That's why seeing your hair suddenly becoming thinner, while the amount of stray hair left in your hairbrush only builds up, can be alarming for even the calmest of people. Fortunately, if this is something you're dealing with, you're not alone. More than 50% of women will experience hair loss, according to the Cleveland Clinic, and this can be for a variety of reasons. Below WH speaks with top dermatologists about what hair loss can look like, the common causes, and what to do about it. Read on for all the details. What does thinning hair look like? Hair thinning can look different depending on your hair type and the reason behind it. Here are a few examples of what to expect when your hair is thinning. You're losing over 100 hairs a day. You may not be counting every hair that falls out of your head, but it's worth noting that the average person loses between 50 to 100 hairs a day, according to the American Academy of Dermatology Association. Losing more than that could indicate hair loss. Ksenia Rabkovets, MD, a board-certified dermatologist and director of cosmetic dermatology at Montefiore Einstein Advanced Care, notes that people with curly hair may feel like they're shedding more than they should, since whatever falls out between wash days is more likely to stay caught up in the rest of the hair. There are specific areas that are thinning. This can be all over the scalp or in specific sections including near the hairline, the part, or the crown. In this case, the strands look thinner and there's less density in a given area, says Dr. Kovets. You're actively shedding. This can look like running your fingers through your hair and some of it falling out, or finding hair on your pillow or in your drain during showers. Causes of hair thinning. While there are people who have naturally thin hair, sometimes hair thinning is an indication of a bigger problem. There are dozens of reasons why your hair may be thinning, but there are six major ones that stand out because of how often they come up between patients and doctors. This includes the following. You've experienced trauma. Trauma can be physical, like undergoing surgery, pregnancy, extreme dieting, infections, vaccines, and getting in a car accident. It can also be emotional, like losing someone you love or having a high-stress relationship on the rocks. Either way, it can take a toll on your tresses. You can have a shock hair loss, also known as a telogen effluvium, which is self-limited and will resolve on its own, says Deanne Mraz Robinson, MD, Assistant Clinical Professor of Dermatology at Yale New Haven Hospital. Dr. Kovets adds that this can last anywhere from 3 to 12 months after the event that caused it, but it can be considered chronic telogen effluvium if it lasts longer than a year. What to do? Eat a vitamin B-rich diet packed with whole grains, protein, and dark leafy greens to combat hair loss, says New York dermatologist Marina Pareto, MD. Additionally, Dr. Kovets says eating less processed foods, opting for antioxidant-rich foods, and reducing your stress with exercises and sleep is also essential. The good news is that your hair will come back as you feel healthier. For an extra push, Dr. Robinson suggests a clinically backed supplement like Viviscal or Nutrafol that is filled with vitamins and minerals like biotin, niacin, and keratin that encourage and support hair growth. You'll just need daily consistency with taking your pills and a good dose of patience, too. It can take a couple of months before you start seeing a difference. You're putting too much stress on your hair. Do you bleach your hair? Are hot tools always on your bathroom counter? Are you trying keratin this and color me that? If so, it can all simply be too much for your hair, warns Dr. Pareto. Even excessive pulling, touching, and stress twirling strands around your finger can cause tension that leads to thinning. And tight braids and pulled back ponytails that are worn on a continuous basis can all create wear and tear on the scalp and strands, leading to brittleness and breakage that can look like sudden thinning, Dr. Pareto adds. What to do? Lay on the brakes. The less you do, the better for your hair. Go for a more natural color and texture while your hair recovers, and choose gentle, sulfate-free shampoos and conditioners, advises Dr. Pareto. If you're always braiding or pulling your hair back tightly, let it free for at least a few weeks in between styles so it can build back strength. You can also try the aforementioned daily hair supplements containing biotin, vitamins, and minerals to help encourage growth and strength as you rehab your hair. Your hair thinning is hormonal or medical. Sudden thinning hair can be a symptom of anemia, low red blood cell count, hormonal issues, especially related to events like pregnancy, or a thyroid disorder, which are all very common in women, says Dr. Pareto. If any of these are the case, hair loss won't be the only symptom present. With thyroid disease, you'll likely also notice changes in energy level, weight, and skin dryness, and you may experience heart palpitations. Hormonal fluctuations often cause acne, facial hair loss, like in your eyebrows, and changes in your period. What to do? If you suspect there's something hormonal or medical at play, see your doctor for a complete physical with blood work. Your doc should be able to offer more insight into exactly what is causing the hair thinning, along with the best recommendations for treating it. Yael Halas, MD, addresses thinning hair in patients with a couple of today's latest options. Platelet-rich fibrin matrix, which is known as a PRP treatment, involves spinning samples of your own blood to release growth factors, purifying it, and injecting it into the scalp to help stimulate hair growth. This means you're keeping your hair and decreasing thinning, Dr. Halas explains. She also uses SmartGraft, a minimally invasive micrografting technique that harvests hairs, typically from the back of the head or other parts of the body, to replenish thinning areas. Patients can expect to see results in about 3 months, noticeable improvements in 6 months, and a full head of hair growth by 12 to 14 months, she adds. Your hair thinning is hereditary. If your parents have always had thinning hair, and you notice it young, as early as your late teens, it could be androgenetic alopecia, says plastic surgeon Michael Salmanek, MD. The first sign of this kind of hair loss in women is a widening of the part or the ponytail becomes smaller, says Dr. Salmanek. What to do? Combination treatments maximize the potential for new hair growth and prevent continued loss of hair follicles, says Dr. Salmanek. He likes to combine hair supplements and topical treatments like Women's Rogaine, which contains minoxidil to help grow back patient hair. The good news, there are far more options to feel hopeful about now than there were for mom and dad, so thinning can be far better managed. You're getting older. As you get older, you experience hormonal changes that lead to menopausal symptoms that can lead to hair loss. In fact, the hair follicles in the hairline are more affected by this kind of hair loss, says Dr. Kobetz. What to do? If you know that you have a family history of hair loss, you can speak with your doctor to see what can be done to slow down the hormonal aspect of your hair loss. Dr. Kobetz adds that if your family has hair loss from aging, it's in your best interest to be proactive about it as early as possible. If the hair loss is from perimenopause, she also suggests considering hormonal blockers and maintaining a nutritious diet that helps prepare the body for hair growth. You're pulling at your hair. Whether you're twisting, picking, rubbing, or tugging your strands throughout the day, this habit, also known as trichotillomania, can result in hair thinning over time. This definitely comes from stress, and people often don't even realize they do it, explains Dr. Kobetz. She adds that over time, this will look like small, irregular patches of short, broken hairs in the area. What to do? While you should definitely set up an appointment with your dermatologist to treat your hair thinning, it's equally important to speak with a therapist or psychologist. The latter can help you find alternative ways to manage your stress or anxiety to avoid further damage to your hair. When to see a doctor. On many occasions, hair thinning is the result of multiple factors at play. However, Dr. Kobetz says there are some key symptoms to look out for that may warrant a trip to the doctor. Those factors are rapid changes in your hair density, excessive scalp itching, scalp pain, dandruff that's getting progressively worse, and redness and scaly patches on the scalp. While the idea of facing your hair thinning head-on might feel intimidating, the sooner you address it, the better. The longer you wait, the more likely those hairs are not going to be able to come back, says Dr. Kobetz. If you're still unsure what the cause of your hair loss is, talk with your doctor to go over your symptoms. And that was Why Your Hair is Thinning and What You Can Do About It by Grace Gold and Sabrina Talbert. And this is What a Self-Mothering Retreat in Ireland Taught Me About Self-Care by Kristen McGinnis. What does it mean to self-mother? Our retreat leader, Dr. Gertrude Lyons, asks us as we sit in the living room of her beautiful home on the western coast of Ireland. I glance around the room at the five other women who, like me, have crossed oceans and dropped responsibilities to be here. We all look like passengers about to embark on an exciting journey, though we aren't quite sure where we're going. I met Gertrude 2 years before when I acquired her book on for our publishing company, Rise Literary. I started working as her publisher on Rewrite the Mother Code, a book she wrote to help expectant and new mothers redefine their experience as one of self-realization, not self-sacrifice. As a woman who became more myself both at work and at home since having children, I was inspired by Gertrude's work. But through the publishing process, she also became more than one of my authors. Since we were both raised by complicated mother figures, we immediately bonded over our own experiences as daughters who had to create different models of motherhood than the ones we were given. I often joke that we are sisters from the same mother, and in many ways, Gertrude has become like a big sister to me. When she invited me on this incredible week-long self-mothering retreat, she checked my calendar first to see if I would be able to attend. I wanted to say, yes, absolutely. But as the time grew closer, I began to waver. There was the logistical obstacle of leaving my two young children and my demanding job. But there was a bigger emotional obstacle, too. The idea of self-mothering itself. Nonetheless, I got on the plane and flew to Dublin, taking a train across Ireland to Killarney with my dear friend Leanna, who had joined me on the adventure. At Gertrude's home, we faced the question of why we were all there. What does it mean to self-mother? When we went around and shared our definitions that first night, most of our answers had to do with radical compassion, self-love, self-care. But as someone who has worked in the self-help field for a long time, those terms always sound great in theory, but can be really hard to do in practice. I want to have compassion for myself, but I also set unrealistically high goals. I want to have self-love, but I grew up with the kind of criticism that doesn't always make room for it. And self-care is awesome, but sometimes there just isn't enough time, money, or energy to make it happen. For so many of us, our own experiences of being mothered weren't necessarily filled with nurturing care and attention. Whether we had mothers who had to focus more on their work, as mine did, or on the men in their lives, or mothers who just experienced that life is hard and parenting is too, many of us grow up lacking the deep and secure attachment with our mothers that makes us feel whole, that makes us feel unconditionally loved. That first night, after we had shared our definitions, one of the women curled up on the couch. She was suffering from a migraine, and though she had taken medication, the jet lag and lack of sleep weren't helping. We swaddled her in blankets and made her tea. She didn't want to go to bed yet, so instead we checked in on her, and Gertrude made calls to get her migraine prescription filled. We mothered her, and by the next morning, her migraine was gone. Trauma experts have long believed that one can heal trauma by building healthy, secure attachments with other people. It is part of how we reparent ourselves, rebuilding the broken pieces of our past through new, more loving relationships with people in our present, even if those people are five strangers you have just met in Ireland. The next night, we all went on a hike to see the Milky Way. We were told by our Irish guide that it should be an easy 45-minute walk, just a tad uphill. 3 hours and a 90-minute vertical climb later, we all stood delirious on a mountaintop looking at a cloudy sky in Ireland, the Milky Way obscured despite our significant efforts. We began to tell each other stories of the people we loved back home, our children and animals, our spouses and friends. We remembered what we had left behind on the other side of the world. Then suddenly, above our heads, the whole Milky Way was exposed across the Irish sky. That night, as Leanna and I walked together back down the hill, we began to traverse a wet and muddy section of the path. I was wearing wellies, but Leanna had on laced-up tennis shoes, the kind made for a friendly morning hike, but not a trek through the mud at night. I led the way with my red headlamp, instructing her as we walked through the sludge. Go right, go left, stay straight. Me the mama duck and she the baby following closely behind as we navigated our way down the hill and headed home. As we walked in the dark, I couldn't help but think how much the women in my life have mothered me through some of my darkest days. When I'm mad at my husband, a frequent consequence in marriage, it is my female friends who listen on the other end of the line. When we were struggling financially, my friends were the ones who offered to loan us money and help out with the kids. Though my own mother can be an incredible support, it is my female friends who consistently show me what it means to care for someone unconditionally, even when I've made mistakes, even when I'm wrong. Because, as I began to see that week, self-mothering is also a lot about remothering one another. We show up, we make the tea, we call in the prescription. We offer one another something rarer than unconditional love. We offer one another unconditional care. Because love can be an elusive feeling, but care is an everyday practice. At one point, I sat in our van traveling to a set of sacred stone ruins as my new friend Jillian wept in my arms. I held her like I hold my own children, kissing her head and stroking her hair. Hours later, she would do the same for me when I recognized how exhausted I was by my own life back home, shuddering with sobs on one of the stones we had gone to visit, crying into it as though it was my own mother and me a broken child. I finally stood up to find Jillian waiting. Together we walked to the van, and she let me share all the feelings that my own mother might fear to hear. My loneliness in the sea of to-dos, and the ever-shifting nature of my own marriage and my role as mother. For each of us on that magical trip in Ireland, we learned that self-care can be a wonderful thing, but caring in community is where the real healing takes place. Because it's in offering unconditional care for one another that we can begin to receive unconditional care for ourselves, and we begin to weave a new story of what it means to be a mother. That was What a Self-Mothering Retreat in Ireland Taught Me About Self-Care by Kristen McGinnis. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kathy Bostrom, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
The strength you have in you, from the blood you carry within you.